Well, for years, Michael Pollan has told us about what happens to our bodies when we eat plants. Now he wants the world to have a more open and honest conversation about what happens when we consume psychoactive plants. That probably makes you think of hallucinogens, but he also includes opium and even caffeine in that category. Pollan laments the world's dysfunctional relationship with drugs. Drugs that may, he says, have therapeutic benefits. His latest book is called This Is Your Mind on Plants, and he's with me now to tell us more about his research, or rangahau. Hello there, Michael.
Hey, Jesse, how are you?
I'm great. Hey, why this topic, and why these three drugs, if in fact you define them as drugs, opium, caffeine, and mescaline?
Well, they're definitely drugs. There's things we take in small amounts that changes us in certain ways. I pick these three because they represent three broad categories of drugs: uppers, downers, and what I think of as outers. The outer is the psychedelic, mescaline. The downer is opium, which is a sedative. And the upper is caffeine, a drug that, 80 or 90% of us are involved with on a daily basis and that we all know is a stimulant. I also pick these three, though, simply, honestly, because they're great stories. They tell great stories about the human engagement with psychoactive plants and my own engagement with psychoactive plants, since I have a relationship with all three of them.
The book begins with an essay you did 25 years ago for Harper's, Opium Made Easy. Tell us about the uproar it caused all those years ago.
Yeah. So I got in a little hot water. I was at the height of the drug war. This was the summer of 1996. I was a gardener. I was a garden writer at the time. I was writing essays about the garden, and I got a hold of this underground press book called Opium for the Masses, that claimed that you could, from commonly available seeds of Papaver somniferum, for the gardeners in your audience, you could grow these beautiful flowers that also produced opium in their seed pods. And I thought, that would be cool, grow my own opium. And I started corresponding with the author, a man named Jim Hogshire, who had done this little book. And he was giving me horticultural advice, and I was asking him for seeds, and we were going back and forth by email. And then I got word that he'd been arrested, that a SWAT team, 20 guys in black ninja suits, broke into his apartment, threw him up against a wall, and arrested him for the crime of manufacturing a narcotic. All the evidence they had was a box of poppies from a florist shop, dried poppy heads, which we've all seen, commonly available, and the book itself, which proved his intention of turning those dried poppy seeds into poppy tea, which is narcotic. And I had no idea that if you grow poppies with the intention of turning them into opium, you are violating a very serious federal law. So that started this summer of fear and paranoia, because now the authorities, had his hard drive and had information that I was doing what he was doing. And I got tangled up in this weird little front in the drug war, where the government was actively trying to discourage people from growing poppies, and actually discourage seed merchants from selling them, even though they're perfectly legal. And I wrote this long piece about my adventures and what I learned about the drug war, and how much power it gave the government to really wreck your life if they wanted to. And then when I handed it in, there were lawyers who read it for the magazine who said, you'd be crazy to publish this. but in particular, there were a couple sections, one where I described how you made the poppy tea from the dried poppy heads, and the other, what it felt like to drink it. So I cut those sections, and I've always felt bad about that self-censorship. And I thought it was time to take another look at this, as the drug war is really beginning to come to an end in the U.S., and republish it. The other thing I know now that I didn't know then, that the very summer that the government was focused on people like me growing a little opium poppies in their garden, Purdue Pharma, the pharmaceutical company, was introducing OxyContin.
Yeah.
And with that, legal, perfectly legal, FDA-approved opiate was launching the opioid crisis that would kill hundreds of thousands of people in the subsequent years. And it was a great example of the limitations of journalism, because we couldn't see this at the time, and the necessity of history, which shows us that really the government was focused looking at the wrong problem, and that they really should have focused on this, the way this opiate was being marketed, really pushed on people, and they were being encouraged by their doctors to take more than they needed to, and many of them got addicted.
Yeah, there are plenty of paradoxes there. Your hesitancy to put a recipe for opium tea in your article, given what was happening with pharmaceutical companies, the different ways you can look at the legality of growing poppies depending on what you planned to do with them. In New Zealand, voters recently rejected a referendum to legalise marijuana. You say the war on drugs is ending. Perhaps it isn't here, or perhaps it's just evolving.
Well, I think it's going to end everywhere eventually. We see some countries that are kind of withdrawing from it, like Portugal, which has legalized all drugs in small amounts. And if you get a, you know, if you have a problem with it, they work on treatment rather than incarceration. But voters in America seem to have woken up to the fact that this drug war is a losing cause, that it has not prevented tremendous drug problems, such as the opioid crisis, which began with legal drugs, and that you know, the collateral damage has been fantastic. I mean, you know, the number of people of color who've been incarcerated on drug crimes, the fact that that drugs are illegal empowers the cartels, which now have so much power in Mexico and in Colombia and Bolivia. We've empowered them by making these drugs illegal. And at this point, you know, the cartel in Mexico is more powerful than the Mexican government. So the damage being done both to our population and to nations like Mexico is so intense, and it hasn't reduced the use of drugs. So it's time to try some other ideas. And in this country, in the 2020 election, five states legalized cannabis. Four of them traditionally red states. It's not like the Republicans want to fight the drug war anymore. The state of Oregon actually legalized psilocybin therapy with magic mushrooms. The state government will be licensing psychedelic guides, believe it or not, and licensing growers of magic mushrooms. And Oregon also decriminalized all drugs. If you get arrested for using any kind of illicit drug, you get moved into treatment, not incarceration. So the voters are ahead of the politicians here, and the voters are suing for peace in the drug war.
The next drug, I'm talking to Michael Pollan, by the way, about his latest book, and the next drug you talk about is caffeine. Would you recommend our listeners give up caffeine for a little while at least, and would you recommend they do it cold turkey?
Well, I'm not against caffeine use. In fact, I'm drinking a cup of green tea right now as we speak, and I drink a cup of coffee every morning. But it is useful to get off caffeine for a period of time, if only to understand what a powerful drug it is and how dependent you are on it, because you will go through withdrawal, especially if you do it cold turkey, as I did. I gave up caffeine for 3 months, and I did it as an experiment to see, to understand my relationship with it. And this was at the on the advice of a researcher I was talking to, who said, you can't understand any substance you're involved with until you stop for a little while and examine it. And it was really hard to do, I have to say, Jesse. I was miserable for a week. I couldn't get any work done. I was totally distractible. I felt like I had acquired attention deficit disorder. There was like a veil between me and reality, and I didn't really like it. And this went on to one extent or another for 3 months. I didn't feel myself. And, you know, when I put it that way, I realized, wow, myself is a caffeinated self. That's my default consciousness. I don't feel normal without it. And so I found that all very interesting. There were two positive aspects to giving up caffeine. One was I slept like a teenager again. I had some of the best sleeps I'd had in 40 years. And that was fantastic. Caffeine does interfere with your sleep, the quality of your sleep, the depth of your sleep. The other great thing about it was getting back on. That first cup after 3 months off was psychedelic. It was so powerful and so wonderful. The sense of euphoria and well-being and energy and focus and the ability to get stuff done that day. It was just great. Unfortunately, though, as we lapse back into our relationship of dependence, we lose that. The drug loses that power. And most of our use of caffeine is really now, we get a little lift from it, obviously, and it helps us with our work in all sorts of ways. But a lot of caffeine use is just stopping the withdrawal, which is very unpleasant.
Yeah.
I do recommend it. I'm not anti-caffeine, though. I think caffeine is very good for your health. It's very good for your work. And I included in the book a legal drug just to make people understand that our relationship to drugs, we should be able to work them out on our own. I mean, some drugs are very good tools, and even some illicit drugs are very good tools, and that we should reconsider what we mean when we use the word drug. And keep in mind that, 90% of our species is involved with this one particular drug. We even give it to our children in the form of soda.
Yeah. You mentioned drinking green tea, which has caffeine in it, although would I be right in suggesting that the caffeine, when you get it from tea, almost has a calming effect rather than a jolting effect?
You know, there's something about the caffeine in green tea, and I think it has to do with another alkaloid or chemical in the tea that stretches out the effect. You don't get a jolt. It's a very even effect, and which I think is very pleasant. Green tea can have quite a bit of caffeine, however, if it's the first growth, the new leaves when they come out in the spring. Tea made from that, even green tea, is pretty strong. But in general, tea has half as much caffeine as coffee, and coffee delivers its caffeine punch with real, you feel it. I mean, it is it's a real jolt. It can be a real jolt.
Which isn't to say that it goes away quickly, but you point out that if you have a cup of coffee at noon, I think around a quarter of it is still in your system at midnight. If people are having problems with their sleep.
Yes, it has a very long half-life or quarter life.
Yeah.
And that's why even that cup you have at noon can affect your sleep. But in general, I think if you knock off before noon, you're not going to have much trouble with sleep. I mean, it won't be as good as no caffeine in your system, but it'll be tolerable.
Do we call caffeine an addiction, and does it matter?
Well, the word addiction is not used anymore by psychiatrists and the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. They speak in terms of dependence. But in common parlance, it's an addiction. Your body needs it to feel normal. You undergo withdrawal. But we moralize this word addiction in a way that perhaps we shouldn't. I mean, to be addicted to something that is doing no harm to your body, that you have access to, you can afford to use it, it's not wrecking your life. I fail to see what's wrong with that.
The current book is called This Is Your Mind on Plants. Last time I spoke to Michael, it was about his previous book, How to Change Your Mind, and there are elements of that one in this one. The book ends with mescaline and talks about your own experimentation with it. Can you explain what it is and how native indigenous cultures have used it over the centuries?
Yeah. So, in How to Change Your Mind, I looked at psychedelics from a very Western perspective. Mm-hmm. And very scientific perspective. I was looking at the research, but I kept learning about the fact that a lot of what we know about psychedelics, we've learned from indigenous peoples who have been using psychedelics a lot longer than people in the West have. In fact, in the case of mescaline, which is produced by a couple different varieties of cactus, including peyote and San Pedro, sometimes called Wachuma, has been used for, it looks like, more than 6,000 years. And so I became curious as to what could we learn from the ways that people with more experience of these psychedelic substances have used them. And the Native American Church is just a fascinating case. In America, as in New Zealand, Native populations were, treated really badly, particularly in the 19th century. In America, we set out to destroy Native American culture. It was official government policy. We were kidnapping children from their families and tribes and putting them in boarding schools where we cut their hair and made them wear Western clothes. And the goal, as expressed by the headmaster of one of these places, was to kill the Indian and save the man. So it was at a period of near annihilation for American Indian populations that they revived a practice that had been used by some Indians for a very long time, and that was peyoteism, the use of peyote in ceremony. And this evolved into something called the Native American Church, which still is going on. It's very strong right now. There are probably 250,000 members, if not more, where peyote is used in a ceremonial context to heal. And it has been very effective to deal with the trauma of Native American life and alcoholism, which is a particular problem on reservations and among Native Americans. And the Native Americans I interviewed, you know, spoke about peyote as something that had really kept their culture alive and saved it from annihilation. And so what do we learn from that? Well, you know, psychedelics in the West were very disruptive when they showed up very suddenly in the 1950s and 60s. They disrupted our society in good ways and bad ways. But in this Native context, they're actually quite conservative. They preserve culture. They don't disrupt it. And they're used in this very moral healing way. And they're used in a very different way. So what I think is significant to take away from the Native example is the fact that you don't use psychedelics casually. It's always done with a purpose, to heal, to have a rite of passage for somebody. You do it in a group. It's socially cohesive. There's always an elder involved, somebody who knows the territory and can guide people through the experience. And lastly, it's always done in this with this ritual container. People who use drugs in a ritual or ceremonial way are not the people who get in trouble with them. It's the people who use them willy-nilly all day long by themselves that really struggle, and that there is another model of how to use these powerful substances. And I think the Native Americans, and there are other groups too in South America and no doubt in New Zealand, that can teach us a more healthful way to use these substances.
And you plan to take some peyote yourself with some tribal members, but the pandemic happened. Instead, you found a Japanese-American woman who was willing to lead you and your wife through a ceremony employing something similar, an Andean cactus that also contains mescaline. What was your experience with that?
Well, it was really interesting. The cactus is called San Pedro in English, or Wachuma in Quechua. And it is a cactus that's grown in the Andes and is used in a ceremony. And basically, it's very easy and legal to grow it. It's illegal to turn it into this tea that you make from it. And you essentially cook it as if you're making a vegetable stock from the after removing the thorns. And you have to drink a fair amount of it. It's very mild. But it does some interesting things. It makes you you take it in a group, and it really knits the group together. It kind of puts everybody on the same mental wavelength. You don't have visions, but it softens the edges of self, and lowers the walls of ego, and you feel much less defensive and more open to other people. And then the leader of the ceremony, who called herself a medicine carrier or Wachumera, kind of leads people in prayer. And in the case of the ceremony I was at, my wife, Judith, was really struggling and was crying and was dealing with a very hard interpersonal issue between her and her mother that came up in the ceremony. And Taloma, the woman who led the ceremony, that's what I call her in the book, came and worked with her on it. And it had a very positive effect. It gave Judith a new perspective on this relationship. And it was part of the reason that Judith's mother just died, that Judith was really able to honestly express love for her before she died, which she would have been hard-pressed to do in a truly honest way before that. So it was a healing ceremony, and everyone participated. Everybody was sending, you know, a certain kind of prayer and good vibe to Judith, and she, I think she felt buoyed by that. So for me, it was a very interesting experience. It wasn't about me at all. I expected it to be about me, but it, you know, I was subsumed in this wave that was working on Judith.
Nonetheless, as long as there are drugs, there will be drug abuse. So what's the best way to talk to someone, and I suppose I'm in particular thinking about a young adult or a teenager, about these plants and their possibilities?
Well, I think that's a really important conversation to have. You know, we're having a very simplistic conversation right now, which is, if the drug's illegal, don't take it. It's bad for you. The government has made a determination it's dangerous. The problem is the government doesn't tell the truth about that. And some of these drugs are not so dangerous. And, you know, psychedelics are an example. I mean, they are virtually non-toxic. There is no overdose for classical psychedelics. There is an overdose for drugs you have in your medicine cabinet that you bought over the counter, things like Tylenol, acetaminophen. They are also not habit forming. That's not to say, you know, you can't get addicted to a psychedelic, but that's not to say they're risk-free. They have psychological risks. People who use them in a careless way or people at risk for schizophrenia can get into trouble. So, and they can be very positive tools for spiritual development in some people, tools for healing in others. But I think they have to be used with great care. I don't recommend them to young people. I think that a drug that dissolves your ego, in effect, should not be used by someone whose ego is still forming. You know, we don't know what that would do. But I think we have to speak more honestly. We have very little credibility with our children around drugs because we're telling them things that they know from experience is not true. So I think more honesty is where we start, and make people understand that drugs are tools, that they have risks, serious risks, and they have benefits, serious benefits, and that you have to weigh that. You know, that's hard to do when you're a young person. I've often said that psychedelics may be wasted on the young, that they're more valuable as you get older in life. And that may well be true. But I think we have to start with honesty. And the other thing we have to do is not lump all these illicit drugs in the same basket. Cannabis and opium and LSD, I mean, these don't deserve to be in the same category. They're such radically different substances with radically different risks. And lastly, we need to remember what the Greeks told us. You know, they called drugs pharmakon, which meant three things. It meant poison, which they are at certain doses. It meant ally, helper. And it meant, lastly, scapegoat. And I think that's really interesting because I think we've scapegoated drugs in many ways. That, you know, with regard to the, you know, to drugs like heroin, we blame the heroin, but, you know, we should be looking at the conditions of people's lives. Instead of a war on drugs, we should be fighting a war on poverty. And that will make drugs less appealing to people in those communities.
Yeah, great place to finish. I've been speaking with Michael Pollan. His new book is called This Is Your Mind on Plants. A real pleasure to chat with you, as always. And thank you very much for your time today.
Oh, thank you, Jesse. Always a pleasure to talk to you, too.